Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Burl Bear definitely is a legendary figure in true crime writing and broadcasting, co-hosting the very first true crime podcast, True Crime Uncensored. He is an Edgar Award-winning author and two-time Anthony Award nominee. Burl Bear is the author of 9 truly important true crime books. In 2000, Murder in the Family was published. In 2004, Broken Doll. In 2008, Mum Said Kill. In 2011, Fatal Beauty. In 2012, Body Count and also Headshot were published. Man Overboard in 2014, and with co-author Frank C. Girardo, Jr., A Taste for Murder was published in 2016, as was Betrayal in Blue. A short story, The Alaska Mail Bomb Conspiracy, was also published in 2016. In this Burl Bear retrospective, we will discuss how his true crime writing career began, his very first case and book, the murder cases that shaped his career, and his incredible personal experiences with psychopaths and serial killers writing these now 9 true crime classics. The episode tonight is Burl Bear retrospective with my special guest, investigative journalist and author and podcaster extraordinaire, the legendary Burl Bear. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this program.
It's always a pleasure and an honor to be on your program, and it's always a pleasure to have you on mine, so I think we get along fine.
It's always an honor and a pleasure to have you on this program, True Murder, and this first retrospective, I think it's fitting to have somebody of your stature and your importance in the true crime.
Yeah, I'm about 6'1 in shoes. Yeah, that's my stature. I would point out, your chronology had a couple understandable errors in it.
Yes.
Headshot actually was the first book after Murder in the Family. The date that you have is on the Kensington re-release with the snazzy new cover. So I just thought I'd mention that. And
well, thank you very much. Now,
go ahead,
Burl. Murder in the Family, 1987. Anchorage, Alaska, a murderous, sociopathic 23-year-old nephew slaughters his aunt and 2 of her children.
Yeah.
Now, this is your first book, as I mentioned, Murder in the Family. Tell us what you were doing at that time. How do you manage to become the author of Murder in the Family? Tell us how this happens. How does it come to be?
Okay. I had just published, I didn't publish it myself. But I'd had the book Man Overboard, The Counterfeit Resurrection of Phil Champagne, published by Northwest Publishing Company, the original hardback edition, which is a true crime book, and was Anthony nominated, which was rather nice, as a true crime book of the year. Didn't win, but it was nominated. And it's, as you probably know, it's a humorous true crime book. At least it's supposed to be humorous. It's supposed to... My theory was that instead of investigating into true crime, discovering what all the rules, there's very, very harsh rules at that time in the true crime genre. And so I decided I'd break them all. I'd break the fourth wall. I'd talk to the characters. I'd talk to the audience, the reader. I'd do everything you're not supposed to do. But at the same time, have very strong journalistic ethics, very strong professional underpinnings, because I was a professional journalist. It was kind of a literary experiment. It certainly did, in terms of reviews and critical acclaim, much better than I ever imagined. It did not do in sales as good as I hoped, but in terms of respect, it garnered me a great deal of that. especially from the great Jack Olson, who was probably the, the best true crime writer I ever encountered. And he actually sought me out, came and talked to me, and told me how much he liked the book. And we formed a friendship over that, which, of course, was a lasting impact on me. So it was at the, what they call the ABA, the American Booksellers Association, has their annual conference. And the publisher, Ben Overboard, had a big display for the book. The woman walks up to me, hands me a card, says, "I am your new agent. I'm Charlotte Dial Breeze." And I said, "Well, pleasure to meet you, miss," and a ma'am, whatever. Then she contacts me and says, "Kensington Publishing is looking for an author to write a book about a true crime case in Alaska." And I had one question. I said, "Is there a check attached?" And she said, "Yes, there is." And I said, "Well, I'm obviously the man for the job." Well, it turned out that the fellow who brought the case to Kensington was a former Anchorage police officer. So he had kind of the inside track on it, but he wasn't an author, he wasn't a writer. They wanted the writer. She knew him and knew me and said, "Here's your guy." Well, I guess they agreed. They signed me to a contract, and I did the book. I hadn't done one before. They told me it had to be 100,000 words exactly. It had to be delivered in full on exactly this particular date. Well, coming from a background in radio, if they tell you your Elvis Presley special has to be 59 minutes and 30 seconds, and it goes on the air Wednesday the 12th, it can't be delayed until Thursday, and it can't be 48 minutes long. Everything has to be exact. And so that's on that date, due date, they received by Federal Express a manuscript that was exactly 100,000 words to the letter long. And I get this notebook from this fabulous editor I had there, Karen Haas. She says, "This is the first time I've ever received a manuscript on the exact due date that was exactly 100,000 words, spell check, grammar check." You know, it needed a line edit because I'm not perfect, of course. But she hadn't seen that before. I thought everybody did that. The book is I tried to use a lot of action in it, a lot of adverbs and a lot of verbs to give a feeling of forward motion. And I think if you notice at the beginning of the book, that's how it kicks off. You know, "For so-and-so, the nightmare began on such-and-such." Then I use a lot of forward-moving words to try to drag you kicking and screaming through the first part of the book. And then when it gets to the trial, either you're going to slog your way through that or you're not, or you're going to skip it. I've noticed, I've learned that a lot of true crime fans don't like trials. They're not interested in that. I find them fascinating. In fact, too fascinating. But we'll get into that when we talk about the headshot, which is essentially a book about that.
Headshot. You write that this alcoholic Paul St. Pierre had an urge to kill along with his brother Chris and a friend, Andrew Webb. And the trio terrorized a quiet neighborhood near Tacoma, Washington, with the brutal murder of innocent victims. And that's an understatement. How did you come to, why Headshot? Again, is this a Pinnacle release? Tell us how you came to a little bit about Headshot.
Kensington, I can't talk here for a minute. Let me slap myself in the face. Okay. Kensington's Pinnacle True Crime imprint signed me to a two-book contract. So here I had another book to do. And, okay, what do I follow this with? And my editor, Karen Haas, said, "Well, give me some suggestions." And I was working on a private eye novel at that time. I decided I would write one of those and make myself the hero because, as you and I both realize, no one else is going to make me the hero of a private eye novel. So if that was going to be the case, I had to write it myself. The title of that one is Headlock, which sounds awful lot like Headshot, but it's a totally different book from a different publisher, where I'm the hero of this private eye novel. While I am writing that novel, I am friends with a great journalist and brilliant fellow named Travis Webb, who appears in the book as a, there's a lot of real people in the book. It's a book of fiction with real people in it. And we did this book, and I got great reviews and low sales. This is typical for much of my material. And then he comes to me and says, you know, my my uncle, Andrew Webb, is in prison for murder. And I said, oh, really? That's fascinating, because where I happen to be, right where the prison is, we're in Walla Walla, Washington, where the Washington State Prison is. And he says, yeah, it's a really strange story. My mom has every article and all of this and all of that. And sure enough, she did. And I looked at this story and I went, this is really crazy. I mean, this is an insane story. And then when I started looking at the trials and the legal stuff that went on, it was every bit as insane as the people and the crimes. And just as bizarre. I've never seen, well, I'm sure if I looked hard enough, I'd find plenty of prosecutorial misconduct. But the prosecutorial misconduct in this case was so severe, you had judges standing up from behind their desk and their robes and screaming, this case is giving me Excedrin headache number 853, and I can't take it anymore, and storming out of the courtroom. I mean, they were just fed up. So it was like, three trials, so was it, what, two mistrials, three appeals to the state Supreme Court. Sentencing documents went missing. After the book was written, I was contacted by Christopher St. Pierre's attorney, saying that Christopher, who should have been out by then, was still in prison. I said, well, why is he still in prison? He should have been out, you know, a couple of years ago. And he said, well, he was sentenced to serve his sentence concurrently, but their prison's trying to say he has to serve it consecutively, which would be he'd be there forever. I said, no. He said, well, do you have the sentencing documents? I said, well, it was covered by the press, big front page article in the paper. It's no secret what his sentencing was. He said, well, where is the actual sentencing document stamped by the state, signed by the judge? You must have it because we can't find it. And I had a copy of absolutely everything related to the case. The state of Washington had never seen anyone get as much material from them as I did in writing that book. I couldn't believe it. I had to rent a van to take all the stuff from the state Supreme Court library or warehouse or whatever. There was so much material. And no one could find the sentencing documents. And I went through there and said, no, it's missing from here, missing from everywhere. And that's not a coincidence. That's intentional. And so then they said, well, is there any way else you can find it? Well, of course, I got the newspaper articles, but they wouldn't accept that. I tried to get the videotapes. The TV station had videotaped the sentencing, but a new company bought the TV station, and that tape was erased. And so they would not let this guy out of prison, despite they even brought the judge and the court reporter back into a courtroom and had them testify as to what the original sentencing was, and the Department of Corrections would not accept that either. And they kept the guy in prison. The only reason they let him out is he got, I believe, multiple sclerosis, and they let him out because he was so ill. And he was the one fellow he had the least to do with any crime. He's the one who went to the police and said, my brother and Andrew Webb killed these people. And I can't, you know, I just can't keep my mouth shut about it. The prosecutor, in one of his great brilliant moves, said to the press, the first one through the door gets the deal. Well, the first one through the door was Andrew Webb, the most guilty of them all, and he made a deal with the prosecutor. In return for there not being a death penalty, in return for their for him getting the ability to be paroled, so he didn't get life without parole, he got life with possibility of parole, he would testify against Christopher St. Pierre and Paul St. Pierre and implicate them in the murder of these two people. And he got up on the stand he didn't do it. He said, no, actually, they didn't. I'm totally responsible. I take full responsibility. I'm the one who slit the throat of Damon Wells, and that's what the trial was about, that particular murder. And he says, and they had nothing to do with it. They were there, they were shocked, but they did not kill the kid or know I was going to kill him. Well, of course, the prosecutor was outraged because he'd already signed the deal. It was already a done deal. And so he tricked the prosecutor, and he actually told the truth when he got up on the stand. And the truth was that the other two guys had nothing to do with the murder of Damon Wells. He was the only one responsible. But even though Christopher St. Pierre was found guilty of that, and then it was overturned, but he was found guilty of the second murder. I mean, it's just a mess, total mess. But it's, it was a difficult book to write. A lot of work went into that one. And people either found it absolutely horrifying to read. And I'll tell you, the pictures are shocking, and I didn't pick them. Usually I'll pick the photographs of the book. I sent them all in and said, someone else is going to have to pick them. I don't know what was going on with me at the time, but I wasn't available to be helpful in that. And the regular person just wasn't there. And so there are pictures in there that are so disturbing that I got to warn you. I mean, you see pictures of the decomposed body of Damon Wells, and, you know, it's really horrible stuff, more than I would want to see. But sure. Anyway, so that's the story on that one. And both the books came out at the same time. Headshot, which is the true crime book about Andrew Webb and the St. Pierre's, and Headlock, which is the Private Eye novel with me as the hero, and featuring Travis Webb. All both come out at the same time, so people, including myself, often get the titles of the two books confused. Although Headshot sold much better than Headlock. Although Headlock is available in a new edition with a fancy new cover from Wild Blue Press.
Let's talk about Broken Doll. I know that when I started my true crime journey, I mean, I've only been involved not even 20 years in reading true crime, but one of the very first people that I saw and was Burl Bear. And the book that I saw, the very first book I saw from you was Broken Doll. In 1995 in Everett, Washington, a 7-year-old Roxanne Doll was abducted, raped, and murdered by Richard Matthew Clark, a trusted family friend. This is an incredibly disturbing and unforgettable story, Broken Doll.
Oh, it's horrifying. What's really horrified me was the cover, because it says, "Parent's Worst Nightmare," and then my name. But aside from that, if you get inside the book, it's even worse. Yeah, it is a terrifying story. And what's really heartbreaking about the whole thing is not only is the rape and murder of Roxanne Doll a terrible tragedy, the life of the guy who did it is a terrible tragedy. There is not a happy moment in his life in this entire book. I mean, it's just heartbreaking. And the thing is that as awful as the crime is, this Richard Matthew Clark is in that classification of what they call situational child molesters. And they are, according to all research, the easiest people to treat. He never received any treatment, never received any counseling after the first time he ever did something that was questionable. All they did was lock him up in a cell in Snohomish County Jail for 12 months and then let him out. And had he, and I mean, I talked to situational child molestation experts, and they all said the same thing, and that was, hey, we could have fixed that guy in those 12 months if we would have had therapy. So those are the easiest people to treat, because it's not about any sort of sexual obsession, you know, in their mind. It is a feeling of extreme powerlessness, and they pick on someone who has no power. It's kind of like a bully, except extreme. And it's people who have been extremely as what they had done to them, pretty much what they're going to do to somebody else, trying to do a role reversal. And when they're feeling extremely powerless, that's the only way. But they're not aware of what they're doing. It's not a conscious thing. But once you're made consciously aware, you know, it kind of like breaks the cycle for some reason. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a psychologist or psychiatrist. But these people are the ones that are treatable as opposed to, shall we say, a pedophile who acts on their pedophilia. Most pedophiles never do act on their pedophilia. And they're even afraid to go get help for it because it has such a bad reputation. So it just stays. They don't get help and they don't get better, but at least they don't do anything bad. But situational child molesters can be treated, which would be a great blessing to society because they wouldn't do things like Richard Matthew Clark did. And once you get past a certain point, you know, then everybody suffers. And he suffered all of his life, and then the family of Roxanne Dahl had to suffer. So it was just tragic all the way around. The family lived very close to me. I was living in Mukilteo, Washington, which is right by Everett. And, in fact, her father actually lived just a few blocks from me. So it was very easy to stop by and chat with him. And he's got his daughter's face tattooed on his chest, his arm, or whatever. It's just And the detective, Herndon, the guy who kind of solved the case, he was the youngest fellow ever to become lead detective in Everett, Washington, and solved the case and was almost immediately demoted back to driving a beat in the cop car for no known reason.
Well,
it's just, it's peculiar. Everything. This is one of those. I mean, you write true crime books. I was warned by Gary C. King when we were actually in a bus at the. This would be a voucher card. When After Bad Overboard came out, I was just about to do Murder in the Family, and I was chatting with him. And of course, we've been doing true crime for a while. And I told him, he says, "Well, that piece of advice for you, Burl." He says, "Be prepared to cry a lot." He says, it's going to be very emotionally draining. He says, you can wind up being hard, you know, cynical, whatever. Mm-hmm. But he says, most of us writer types, artsy-fartsy types, tend to be rather emotionally sensitive. He says, so be prepared to cry with the family, to be haunted by the images you see. You know, and I can't, with Murder in the Family, I kept pictures of Nancy's two kids, their school pictures, scotch taped to my computer, you know, a desktop computer while I wrote, so I never forgot who I was writing about.
Yeah, absolutely. You have a fascinating story. I mean, all of these books include fascinating stories, but this one is, again, one that just sticks out a little bit more, this Mum Said Kill. Just for the heinous nature of this plan, of this plot. Jerry Hyman, in 2001, terminal cancer, he had hired Barbara Marie Opel as a healthcare provider and housekeeper, and she hatches a plan to have two teens and her own three children to kill Hyman.
Yeah.
Again, you say you can't be detached from these stories. You can see why. Maybe somebody could say, well, you have to be detached. You have to be unemotional. But to delve as deep as you have to in this investigation that you undertake to write these books, you're the furthest thing from detached, aren't you?
Yeah. I say this about every one of the books, every one of the stories. Well, this is really a strange one. Well, they're all strange. There's so much true crime around. It's not only in real life. And people who read a lot of true crime tend to think there's more of it going on than there is. To prove that there isn't, all you got to do is watch ID and see how many times the same crime comes up on the different programs. it isn't quite enough. We don't have enough true crime, nor have enough murders that are strange enough to make a show out of. If I was programming a true crime channel, I would want the same thing they want, or Oxygen wants. I want stories that have got something strange to them, a twist to the tale. if it's a smoking gun, you know, Sally comes in and shoots Joe, that doesn't make a, you know, an half hour or hour TV show. You got to have the investigation. You got to have something strange to it. And now in this particular story, when Mom said kill, the twist of the tale isn't, gee, it was hard to solve because it was easy to solve. That wasn't a problem. What's so strange is the fact that the murder took place in the first place, that it even happened. What I found particularly fascinating was the relationship between Barbara Opal and her daughter, Heather. Heather did whatever Mom said. That's why I called the book Mom Said Kill. Mom says kill, you go kill. You do whatever Mom says. That was really the dynamic of the relationship. Unfortunately, the mother was no more intellectually or maturely advanced than her daughter. She was essentially one of the kids, except a very bossy one. She was the alpha child, shall we say. She had her own, shall we say, mental limitations. I don't mean such like, ah, she was crazy. I mean, she did actually have, or does have, limitations. Among them being, in planning this crime, which she worked on this, Dan, she really was obsessed with killing her employer, who was really a nice guy, nice to her, nice to the kids. Why? Why did she want to kill him? He had $40,000 or something like that in his bank account. She wanted to get the money, and she figured if she killed him, she could get the money. She could steal the money. She did not think or plan past the moment when his body hits the ground. If you're going to plan a murder, which is not a bright thing to do, but if you were, hopefully you would, if you wanted to get away with it, you would plan on what you do after you kill the person. You know? In the opening of the book, A Taste for Murder, Frank and I talk about all the different ways to kill somebody and why you're going to get caught every time. You know, it just doesn't work. You know, you're just not going to be able to get away with it. She didn't even think about trying to get away with it. She just thought about doing it. So now she's got a dead body on the floor. And it never occurred to her, what do I do now?
Yeah.
She didn't run away. She just moved two blocks away down to the motel. I mean, there was just no, duh, what do I do now, thought given to the whole project. It was just, I'm going to kill him and then I'll have the money. So it was really easy to catch him. But it's the whole thing of the dynamics between the mom and the kids. And the youngest kid, Tiffany, having to clean up the blood and the brains from the wall. Felt sorry for her. She was, after the book came out, she would go into the grocery store nearby where she lived, and what book is plastered, has just come out and is in the number one position there, and it's Mom Said Kill with her mom's picture, you know, right there on the front, and it kind of freaked her out. So the store, much to my room, I thought the store should have held firm and kept the book on the shelf. No, they took the book down. You know, it could be easier to tell the kid, you know, don't walk over to the book department. But, So that's just a strange story.
Mm-hmm. You have another story contained in Fatal Beauty with wealthy Jimmy Jost's longtime lover, Rhonda Glover, claimed after 15 years that Jost was violent and threatened her, and she had to kill him in self-defense.
Oh, that would
but
be
again,
it.
Yeah, but in the court, we heard stories, and you reported on them, of devil worship and sexual perversion and self-defense whatsoever.
I don't know if there was any sexual perversion. There was just a lot of sexual participants. I mean, they were stacked like cordwood. I don't know if that qualifies as perversion or not. But she was, this is Blog Talk Radio, isn't it? So cover your ears, kids. I think the technical term for Rhonda Glover is she's batshit crazy, nuttier than a fruitcake. And the interesting thing is, if there was an interesting thing about this case, when I got hold of Rhonda, unlike most people who got her by the ears, I just got hold of her by writing. I said, Rhonda, I want you to be able to comment on everything in this book. I want to play to her ego. You know, I'm going to give you free rein. You can say whatever you want. You can correct it. You can, you know, contradict it, everybody. I want you to have full rein on this. And she says, well, can... she says, you know, I've never been in a mental institution. I've never had any mental problems. People try to say I'm crazy. Can you get my mental records? I can't get them. Can you get them? Oh, I got them all right. She's been in and out of mental institutions all of her life, poor thing. Right. And never had really real comprehensive ongoing treatment. If she had meds, she didn't take them. She had been diagnosed... I came up with the phrase I use in the book, is where they know that she's got a severe mental problem, a psychosis of some sort, but not otherwise specified. It was they could never hold her still long enough or hold her down long enough to do a thorough enough critique or examination of exactly what kind of psychosis she had and what was triggering it. On top of that, she was self-medicating with massive amounts of methamphetamine and cocaine, which wasn't exactly helping her mental state, adding to her paranoia. She thought there were demons in the walls, her primary delusion was that her husband, kind of her common-law husband, her longtime boyfriend, Jimmy, father of her child, that he and George W. Bush were having homosexual sex with clones in the cave under her house.
Right.
Now, you'd think that that alone would disqualify her from being fit to stand trial. But they made her fit to stand trial by giving her Seroquel or something to calm her down, and then they took her aside and said, listen, Rhonda, you can't mention the cave or the clones or the devil because it's too dangerous. If you talk about that, it's too dangerous. And she took that to mean if you talk about it, these demons are going to come kill your kid or kill you or kill your mother. And so because it was too dangerous to talk about it in the courtroom, it was never brought up. If it had been brought up, someone might have said, hey, wait a second, what's she doing testifying? She's obviously nuts. But they had her competent to stand trial. She wasn't really competent to stand trial. In my opinion, she wasn't competent to sit trial, let alone stand trial. And I went to see her in prison. It was a strange experience. I usually don't go see the murderers or the accused or the psychopaths in prison. I got enough psychopaths walk around the streets of Los Angeles. I don't need to go see them in prison. Mm-hmm. And she's on the other side of the plexiglass. And... fortunately, I had quite a lot of experience dealing with people on psychedelics back in the 60s who have the attention span of a goldfish. You know, oh, look, there's a castle. Oh, look, there's a castle. That was kind of like dealing with Rhonda. If I pissed her off, I could put her in a good mood immediately by going, oh, Rhonda, I got to tell you how brilliant you were to say such and such. And right away, her face would light up with a blazing smile. And she just, you'd see her puff up like a blowfish. I hate to use the word manipulate, but I could at least influence her mood. If I said something that made her mad, you could see it instantly, and that was kind of scary. But I could, change the channel by what I said. And I did notice how she would modify things depending on what was in the news lately, things changed. Oh, yes, Jimmy was into that if it was something bad, she always felt that he was in league with the devil, that his face was on the $20 bill, except on the $20 bill, his face, that he was wearing a leather gag mask, S&M stuff, which he wasn't, of course. It was real peculiar talking to her. And, people were very concerned about her mental state. But it wasn't, it's not always easy to get someone with mental health problems to get them help. When she was first arrested, they didn't arrest her for murder. They arrested her on firearms violations. And you want to talk about, gun control. Here, this woman who has been in and out of mental institutions or mental health facilities all of her life, who is diagnosed as having psychosis, you know, was purchasing a weapon, is, you know, down there at the firing range practicing on killing this guy. She's even asked the instructor, okay, let's say I'm upstairs and this guy's coming up the stairs to see me. You know, when I'm in this room, how do I shoot him? You know, they arrested her on firearms violation because when she filled out the paperwork, she didn't tell the truth. You don't didn't do a check. They don't take those forms and go check to see if you're honest or not, which is a great boon for the mentally ill and the dishonest. She put down false address. She put down a false personal history, and she lied on her firearm registration. That's a crime. That's what she was arrested for. They didn't want to hurry up and do the murder charges until they already had her in custody. Similar to Kirby Anthony, when they arrested Kirby Anthony up in Alaska on the Newman murder homicides, they didn't arrest him for murder. They arrested him because there was a marijuana cigarette in the ashtray. Mm-hmm. That's how they arrested him. And if I could flash back to that one just for a moment, you know, in addition to Kirby Anthony having killed Nancy Newman and her two little kids, he also murdered some other people. He murdered Walter Napageek, who was a transsexual in Anchorage, because he didn't know that Walter was Walter, and had Walter perform oral sex on him. And then when he figured out that Walter was a guy and not a girl, he murdered him, put him in a wheelbarrow, and dumped him in an alley. And if the cops mentioned to Kirby that he'd murdered these two little kids, didn't faze him that he murdered the little kids. But if they mentioned Walter, Kirby would just get furious because it was upsetting. Not that he killed anybody, but it was upsetting that he'd had sex with Walter when Walter was a guy.
Sure.
You know, he didn't mind killing little kids, but having sex with Walter,
yeah.
Oh, he was furious about that.
Yeah.
He also apparently killed a 12-year-old girl, allegedly, back in Idaho. That's why they went to Alaska, to get away from that.
Yeah.
They had problems.
Incredible tale. Incredible tale.
Yeah.
That became a bestseller, too. That book was very,
yeah,
very popular.
Yeah, New York Times bestseller. Boy, were we surprised about that. That was the farthest last thing I expected, is a paper, mass-market paperback, true crime book. And my first, you know, shall we say, serious one, because Man Overboard was humorous. My first serious one, my first one for Kensington, was going to be a New York Times bestseller. I would never believe you. And, of course, they didn't believe it. They didn't believe it either. They weren't prepared for it. But when it first hit the New York Times bestseller list, was the same week we ran out of books, because it sold so many so fast, they didn't have any more books to sell. So it was on its way up. The next week, it would have been the top 10 bestsellers. It was just on the edge there. You know, it made the list, but it would have been even higher if they'd had more books to sell. They didn't.
Yeah.
So it dropped back down. And I don't know why it was New York Times bestseller. It must have been the title, because people don't know what a book, if they like a book or not, until after they buy it and read it. So it must have been a combination of the title and the description on the back, I guess. Or once people read it, they recommended it to other people. It got a lot of great reviews, and they look on Amazon, and people say how much it bothered them to read it, but they read it anyway. It's not easy.
Well, you know, doing...
No. Go ahead.
You know, doing this show, I did an interview about Murder in the Family till much later. So just a few years ago, I read Murder in the Family. So I had the perspective of reading it. And now when you say this is my very first book, they were impressed because your writing was impressive. And Jack Olson giving you the accolades that he did. Like you say, Jack Olson, when I first read True Crime, I read Jack Olson. And Jack Olson obviously is a master.
Well, he was a standard of the industry.
Yeah, absolutely. And the stories, too. And you inherited that same ability through Pinnacle and through just where you were geographically at the time, and because of the author that you were able to get stories that resonate, that are just by the description on some of these books, you are compelled to pick up that book.
I want to read that one. You know, the thing is that, as you know, true crime is a female-driven genre. Majority of books are bought by women. And you're really marketing to women, which is somewhat problematic on some of the books, because, like Betrayal in Blue, and I think maybe I'm almost tempted to change the title and change the cover on that, and put his wife's picture on the front with the headline, "My husband was the second most corrupt cop in the history of the NYPD." And I think it's so better. Because we even say in the introduction to that book, which I know you want to talk about later, but as long as we're on the topic, we say right in the introduction that this is a cop story, is a male-driven story, lots of testosterone in here, you know. And the guys can tell you dates and times and places and cadavers, but the women are the emotional barometer, you know, what's going on. And so we start the book, story-wise, with Ken Urell's wife, you know, at home alone with her and the kids and the dog, and all these policemen hiding in the bushes suddenly crashing into her house and arresting her. And she not knowing what the hell's going on. You know, we started from her perspective. And we had her on the show talking about it, too. And that was one of our most downloaded shows, because they had that title, "My Husband, That Jerk, Who I Love With All My Heart," was one of the most corrupt cops in the NYPD. Anyway, go ahead.
When you talk about Betrayal in Blue, too, while we're on the subject, we might as well talk about that, because after Pinnacle decided not to pursue true crime the way they were the premier independent, especially true crime book destination in America and worldwide, Canada, all kinds of international places. They were really the true crime book.
Yeah, they put out one a month,
like
Berkeley. Yeah, they and Berkeley were putting out one a month.
And they were embracing a lot of the stories that I think the true crime audience was looking for. As we saw when the true crime podcast explosion happened, people weren't so adverse to hearing about gore. Whether it's a female audience that primarily reads true crime books, they were not so hesitant to read details. That's what I think Pinnacle was tapping into, that there was the same stories that you and I would read, the women were reading and enjoying and not batting an eye at all the details, even if they were gory and graphic.
A lot of it in the murder, you know, you put murder in the title, it makes a big difference, too. They don't really like murders, but a lot of it is relationship murders and like murder in the family. And you know, women tend to be more relationship tuned in than the guys are, for the most part.
Sure.
And so, I mean, they want to know. There's also that element that they use in news. I'm sure they do in Canada, the United States, and it's real typical of America. There's all newscasts have something to make you feel better or more fortunate than somebody else. You know, I'm not as screwed up as that person, or I got it better than them. And almost all the nightly newscasts will have one little tidbit of that. And something to be afraid of, and then a happy story about an animal. Kind of like a little format. And so you read these stories about husbands who kill their wives who kill their husbands, and some real sick ones like lovers who kill their own brothers and sisters, you know, weird stuff, and they get off on it. Or kind of what's that one that Arbery Flowers did about the couple that traveled around in their van picking up sex slaves and killing them? You know,
sex slaves
murders, that's what it was called.
Yeah.
And you wonder, where the hell do these people come from? I'm glad I don't know them.
Yeah, absolutely.
When I started doing my podcast, True Crime Uncensored, with the great, late great Don Waldman.
Yes.
This is going to be interesting because it was on Outlaw Radio, which is heavy, heavy, heavy male. You know, as I said, it was like for men 18 to 25 with a good chance of doing 25 to 30. We smoke, we drink, we interrupt is their slogan, you know. So like a bunch of bozos. And Matt Allen said, "Burl, why don't you do a show just before mine? What do you want to do?" Well, I just had two crime books come out, and So we'll do a true crime show, and I'll ask Don Waldman, as an attorney, to do with me. He was a regular on Matt's show, too. And so maybe we get men interested in true crime if we do it skewed towards the male audience, joking around, being rude, you know. Now people probably look at us and go, God, what a bunch of a-holes these guys are, you know, because now there's so many true crime podcasts where people are responsible professionals. We may be professionals acting irresponsible. But there was a method to our madness, and that was to try to get guys into paying. And we'd start off, we always start off our show joking around, and then gradually as the show progresses, as a rule, it becomes more serious because his crimes are serious. But we always have that kind of joking guy sitting around in a bar approach because that's how the show began, or that's how the show actually does take place in a bar. In Matt Allen's backyard, you know, it looks, the lighting up lounge. It looks exactly like a, 1876 Nevada style, bar saloon, complete with swinging doors and real alcohol, which I don't indulge in, thank God.
Yes, and fantastic interviews. Let's use this as an opportunity, Burl, to just break for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is Ritual. We all want to do the right thing to keep our bodies healthy in the long run. But even if we try really hard to eat kale salads and drink green smoothies, we're still most likely not getting all of the essential nutrients we need on a daily basis. Enter Ritual, the obsessively researched vitamin for women. Ritual's essentials have the nutrients most of us don't get enough of from food, all in their clean, absorbable forms. No shady additives or ingredients that can do more harm to your body than good. 2 easy-to-take capsules provide 9 nutrients you need to support a strong foundation for your health. My wife Lisa decided to take Ritual. She liked how much research Ritual had put in to create their vitamins. She's taken them for about a month so far, and she feels great. She feels she's well covered nutrient-wise, and really appreciate you can take them without a meal. Ritual Essential for Women is the multivitamin reimagined. From D3 to omega-3, Ritual's Essential for Women helps fill gaps in a woman's diet. Their no-nausea capsule design is gentle on an empty stomach, and there's a mint tab in every bottle to keep things fresh, so you don't get that fishy aftertaste common with most omega-3s. Better health doesn't happen overnight, and right now, Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off during their first 3 months. Fill in the gaps in your diet with Essential for Women, a small step that helps support a healthy foundation for your body. Visit ritual.com/murder to start your ritual today. That's 10% off during your first 3 months at ritual.com/murder.
Hmm.
Now, Burl, we...
Yes.
In every author's career, especially in true crime, an author has the opportunity, we won't say misfortune, but the opportunity to experience a serial killer. In Body Count in Spokane, Washington, first 13, but 15 women murdered. And Robert
More
Lee
than that, probably.
Jr. Probably. Yes,
yeah,
Robert
probably
Lee,
as many
Lee
as 25 or 30. Altogether, if you take other countries into account.
Yeah. This was a respected father of 5 and a helicopter pilot who served in Desert Storm. So this was a complete surprise, but this is the psychopathic serial killer that Robert Lee Yates Jr. was. And your incredible story, Body Count, the book about Robert Lee Yates Jr.
Yeah, that was a book. I'll tell you that. You know, the process of writing these, and you've written one of my favorite and most disturbing true crime books, you know, the Shall We Dance murders, Trophy Kill. You're familiar with
Thank
that.
You.
And you know what it's like to write a book. And it's not easy.
No.
You may get it wrapped up in it, but each one has its own emotional personality when you're writing it. It's never the same. Everyone is its own gauntlet that you got to run, you know, and sometimes it's difficult as hell. I mean, I remember when Mike Taylor Hamilton, chief executive editor of Kensington and Pinnacle True Crime, called me up when I was writing the one with Rhonda Glover, Fatal Beauty.
Fatal Beauty.
Yeah, and I was having a horrible time with that one. I thought that was going to be the easiest one to write. It was the most difficult. Mm-hmm. And she said, "You're drowning in this manuscript, aren't you?" And I said, "I sure am." She says, and she told me what the mistake was, what I had done wrong. I had read the reviews on Amazon of my other books. She always warned me not to do that. She says, "Don't read the reviews." And I read the reviews. Because you always remember the bad ones. And the bad ones, the ones that don't like my books, are the ones that, I don't know why they buy them, they don't like them. But are the ones who don't like trials. They don't like the legal process. And they always say that stupid thing, "Oh, he just put in a bunch of trial transcripts," which no author does that. It just shows how ignorant they are. It's one of the hardest things for a true crime author to do is to take something from a trial transcript and modify it and use it and structure it so it can actually be used in the book. There's no such thing as just taking trial transcripts and putting them in the book for filler. It always pisses me off when they say that. Anyway, so I was purposely avoiding anything that had to do with the legal procedures because I had so many complaints from people who don't like my books about that. And she said, "Here's a piece of advice. Remember this. You write books for people who like your books, not those who don't." Duh.
Yeah.
I went, "Oh, okay. I'll write it for people who like my books." And that helped. With Body Count, there was no legal stuff. Everything was sealed. Everything was... No. The only legal stuff was the disagreements or the ripoff between Spokane or Stevens County, I guess, and Pierce County. Is they had a deal. There were originally that taking the death penalty off the table if he would reveal where the bodies were buried and this sort of thing. And then Pierce County pulled out of the deal and sentenced him to death. But the judge rightly ruled he had already been sentenced to 500 and some years in prison. So after he served the 500 and some years, then you can kill him. So that worked out well. He is a model prisoner because he was very good in the military. So they never have any problems with him. So model prisoner is just fine. And, you know, I did an update on that book for the edition you mentioned, the one with the snazzy cover, kind of a purple cover with a girl standing by a river or something. That's the updated edition. Oh, and there is an updated e-book edition, too. But the they thought originally, and he had these giant billboards of his victims. Well, it turns out the first three or four people on that billboard weren't his victims at all. They were the victims of another serial killer, called the Riverside Killer. And their whole method by which they were killed and how the bodies were dumped and all that stuff was entirely different than Robert Lee Yates. They finally, I believe, caught the suspect. As the DNA improved and the DNA testing improved, they discovered they already had that person in custody on a weapons violation, except it was a woman who used to be a guy.
Ah.
The guy had gone to Taiwan or the Philippines or someplace, had gender reassignment surgery, came back to Spokane as a woman, and had not killed anybody since. I think the defense used what I didn't do, what he did. We just happened to have the same body, I guess. That was kind of strange. But I knew some of the victims of the Spokane serial killer. My daughter went to school with his kids. We lived in the same town more than once. And we both lived in Walla Walla, Washington. It was actually in College Place, a little suburb, worked at the prison. Interesting in the illustrations, he worked at Washington State Penitentiary as a corrections officer and they take the pictures of the employees the same place they take the pictures of the prisoners. And so you see his picture, and he'll say, you know, Robert Lee Yates, corrections officer. Next to that, I put the picture of Robert Lee Yates, prisoner, because he used to be a corrections officer in the penitentiary, and now he's a prisoner.
Yeah.
Yeah, he moved out of town. The first people he murdered were friends of my family.
Wow.
And they were very cooperative in the doing the book, the Olivers. And then I knew Marla, who he murdered, and or Darla. But there's two sisters, Marla and Darla. Darla's the one that was murdered. Met her several times with my friend Arthur. And that was just, it was all too strange. He was, I mean, no one would ever suspect Robert Lee Yates of being a serial killer. I mean, that's the thing. The only time I've ever heard of people going, ooh, that guy's a serial killer, was my daughter and her friend were standing in line to see Interview with a Vampire. And they're standing in line, and the guy behind them was the Green River Killer. And they're going, ooh, that guy's creepy. I bet he's the Green River Killer. And they were right.
Wow.
But usually you don't get that, you know. It's like the last person you'd ever think of.
That's incredible.
And that was the case with him.
You hooked up with Frank Girardo, Frank Z. Girardo Jr. Tell us a little bit about this collaboration, this co-authoring, and A Taste for Murder.
Oh, yeah, that was great fun. I don't mean the case is great fun because the guy winds up being dead, but working with Frank... You know, people ask, how does that process work, especially on Betrayal in Blue, where it was three of us, Ken Urell and Frank and myself. Here's the real untold story. I used to live in the Pacific Northwest, and I had lots of contacts up there. And if I wanted to know about this or that, I could always know where I could go talk to this guy in the prosecutor's office, or I could talk to this cop, or, you know, because I lived there. And so I was like, you know, homeboy. When I came down here to Southern California, I'm not in that position anymore. I didn't know anybody, and I don't have those contacts. I don't have those relationships. But I'd had this Frank Girardo on my show talking about his book about this the fake Rockefeller guy.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I was really impressed. The guy's a brilliant journalist, won lots of awards, great personality, and knows everybody, because he's been here. I mean, he was like editor of the Pasadena Star News. I mean, the guy's connected. And the guy knows how to write. Great writer. And so it's time for me to write another book. And I'm going, wow. I called up Frank, and I said, hi, I'm Burl Bear. He said, yeah, you remember, of course, knew who I was. I said, you want to do a book? He goes, yeah, sure. So we started doing stuff together, and even some of the stuff we did, which wasn't necessarily very good, like these short little quick and dirties we did. This is really going to upset somebody. We did a quick and dirty little booklet on the Mayling Williams murder, where she murders her husband and her kids. She chops them up with a samurai sword, then sat down and wrote him a suicide note. No one's going to buy that. You know, it's not a full-length book. It's a real short, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But he was one of the first people on the scene. He was on the scene before the cops were, Frank was.
Wow.
So we wrote that up, and we made more money. And that thing sells for like $1, right, because it's just a little booklet. We made more money off of that than any other in an entire year than we did off of any other true crime book in my catalog.
Wow, interesting.
And it doesn't have that good of reviews. You know, I mean, it does have some good reviews, but that's where we made our money. Very strange. But because it was on Deadly Sins. Yeah, Manling Williams' Deadly Sins. And which I was on, you know, with Darren Cavanocchi, one of our friends, a great guy. Mm-hmm. Originally, that was going to be a book that Darren and I were going to do. and it didn't go through as a book, so he turned it into a TV series. And he's been nice enough to have me on every year, a couple times every year. So nice. I got hold of Frank, and he found that case that we did for A Taste for Murder, and he had all the contacts and everything. And the way he explains how we work, I thought was pretty clever. We did an event at the Pasadena Library, and a lot of people showed up, and we sold some books, and they asked us all sorts of questions. And he says, you know, he's also a musician, plays guitar. And he says, it's like being in a band. He says that, like doing an album. He says he goes in, like he's the rhythm section, and he lays down the bass and drums, and then I come in, and I do lead guitar.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And, I mean, we've done two full-length books together, and we've never written in the same room. We've never been in the same place at the same time. I'll write what I write and send it to him, and he'll make a couple notes, suggestions, and send it back. And he'll do the same. We just go back and forth. We don't sit and write together. We just kind of, he writes his stuff, I write mine, and I read his, he reads mine, and I make a couple notes, and he makes a couple notes, and that's how we do it.
Wow, it makes for a great collaboration.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it works real well, you know. He doesn't have to sit here and watch me pretend to type, and I don't have to watch him pretend to type. You know, we read it when he's got it, and he'll polish mine up, and I'll polish his up, and works out just fine. Plus, we made a decision that I thought was smart thing to do. You know, when I was with Kensington, I said when I first did Man Over, there was lots of rules to true crime. One of them is you had to come in at 100,000 words. If the story only took 62,000 to tell, it didn't make any difference. You still had to come up with 100,000 words.
Right.
Also, you had to stick to the facts. You couldn't yak at the audience. You know, you couldn't have.
Right.
You had to be just like Joe Friday, just the facts, ma'am.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we decided, listen, if we were sitting with our friends, if we were sitting with Dan Zapansky, and we're going to tell Dan a story, you know, whether he's leaning back in his chair or sitting on the edge of his seat, he likes hearing true crime stories, and we're going to tell him one. And we're going to tell him one. They'll have him entertained and amused and aggravated and everything else. But we're going to tell it the way we tell it. Someone else may tell it differently, but it's the way we tell it. And we just assume he's going to like it because he likes stories and we like telling stories. And that's how we approached it. And, you know, of all the compliments we got on the book, that's the biggest compliment we got, the way it's written, the style. Because we wrote it just as if we were sitting here with you telling you the story.
Yeah.
And people appreciated that. And we were
going to
use one more word than it took to tell the story. We're just going to tell the story the way we tell the story, and that's it. And that's exactly what we did.
Well, your books, too, they do explore things. And there are other authors that talk about this, but they are rare. But an author says there has to be more to this story. Again, the facts, certainly. And again, it's not an editorial excuse or reason to editorialize, but there obviously is something to be said from each one of these stories.
Well, Jack Olson said that any true crime book that doesn't get into the hows or get into the why and what can we do about it is pornography. And pornography doesn't mean sexual. Pornography means appealing to the lowest basis common denominator here. And so in every one of my books, with the exception of maybe Man Overboard, because it was kind of pretty obvious, they have the author's commentary at the end where we delve into the how do we deal with this? How do we resolve these problems? How do you know? What is the why and the wherefore of this? You know, what can we do about it? You know, based on the research. One of the astonishing things about A Taste for Murder was the story of the woman who did the murder, her life. And, you know, incest. And her sister had said to me, you know, Grandpa was having sex with all of us, but he stopped with the rest of us about the time he usually stopped that sort of thing. Well, I was shocked to hear that. I didn't know there was a time you usually stop having sex with your grandkids. I didn't know there was a time when you started. I mean, that just blew my mind. But I went and looked it up. You know, I had to do a lot of scholarly research on multi-generational incest. And yes, there is a typical time that it starts and a typical time that it ends, if you're going to do it. 3 years. After 3 years of having sex with your grandkids, you usually stop and go on to a new grandkid or something. But Grandpa didn't stop with her. Grandpa kept it up all the way till she was 18. And she had two abortions from being pregnant with Grandpa's kids when she was in high school.
Incredible.
So there you go. But we had to, you know, do a lot of research. And some of the research that you learn things when you do research like this, that when you learn it, it seems so obvious, you wonder, why didn't that ever cross my mind before? For example, if a kid, a little kid, is sexually molested, you feel real sorry for him. Say the kid sexually molested is 13, 14, 15, or she or he, either one. But once they're about 16, 17, you know, you stop feeling sorry for them. And the real problem is that sex feels good, which means psychologically or mentally you may be going, no, 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 but your body's going, yes, 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 yes. And one of the biggest problems that victims of sexual abuse face is that as bad as it was, they enjoyed it physically. And the guilt and shame that they have for feeling what is perfectly natural to feel in a physical situation is horrifying and really screws them up. That's why there are only, and I know we've got a little bit of time left, don't we? There are two responses to sexual violation or brother-sister incest, or father-daughter incest, or grandfather-child incest. Either you become as cold as winter in Anchorage and sexless, or you become what appears to be incredibly promiscuous and have just tons of sex with all sorts of people. You think, well, what? That sounds strange. Why would that be? Didn't occur to me either until I read the research. It's very simple, and I talked to this one woman who she had, everybody in her family was poking the poor girl. Her father, her uncles, her cousins, everybody. She says, being a sex worker, she says, she gets to decide who does what. Nobody else. She's the one who says yes or no. Nobody else. She is in control of her body, her sexual life. Not anybody else. So that every time she says yes, it's her decision, not somebody else's. And it's a reclaiming of her own body and her own sexuality, not being controlled by somebody else. That hadn't occurred to me. You know, maybe it occurs to everybody else, but that hadn't crossed my mind. But all the research says, yep, that's what that's about. And there's no middle ground. Just like if you're a victim of racial or religious prejudice, or people pick on you for being Canadian. There's only two possible responses. Either you're going to become just like the people who pick on you, be just as prejudiced against others, or you're going to be a champion of acceptance and inclusion. No middle ground. And you know, there's no... You know, either you're going to be just as prejudiced as they were, or you're going to be a champion of inclusion. And that's the way it is. And, you know, for some reason, my brain just clicked into the channel of how important it is in any country, Canada, the United States, any country, in terms of its civilization and its functionality, to have a well-informed population, a well-educated, well-informed population, and a well-informed electorate.
Too late.
One of the great tools to destroy a civilization or to manipulate it is to have an ill-informed or misinformed or uninformed population, what they call the low-information voter. The people who are ignorant, they'll just fall for just about anything. And there's always been kind of a general plan in the United States, which I found rather shocking, considering down here it was always said in the Thomas Jefferson, the backbone of America is a well-informed electorate is the backbone of a democracy. Well, a lot of effort has been put into not having a well-informed electorate. Because they're well-informed, you've got some real problems. They're going to see right through your BS. You know, then what do you do? So a lot of mocking of the well-educated, all those ivory tower intellectuals, all the, you know, putting down the well-educated, mocking them. I can remember we had a guy running for president back in the United States years ago, Adlai Stevenson. I was a kid at the time, but I remember what people complained about him was he was too smart. He was too well-educated.
Yeah.
Yeah. That kind of falls into the same category here with you know, I'm glad people are still learning to read so they can buy our books.
Absolutely. You know, Betrayal in Blue, which was released in 2016, the shocking memoir of the scandal that rocked the NYPD and the story of cops Dowd and Kenny Urell. You worked with Frank Girardo and this Kenny Urell, this bad cop from the 75th Precinct. This is an incredible collaboration between you, but it also demonstrates the ability for you to get a journalist and author of Frank Girardo's stature to co-author, but also to be able to get, and I think this is an important part of all the books that you have, is that the respect you have as a journalist, and this is evident when you get to talk to this Kenny Urell, and he gives you the information. It's on Netflix, but the book that you have, Betrayal in Blue, really gets to the character of this Kenny Urell and to tell the truth about the NYPD. I think this is where you, with True Crime Uncensored, had stuff that nobody else had, stuff like this, bad cops finally opening their mouth and telling the truth. This is a powerful book, Betrayal in Blue, but it also, again, indicates and demonstrates the ability for you to have that respect for people to say, yes, I will tell Burl Bear. I will let what Burl Bear...
Yeah, that is a strange thing. And it is true. And in fact, I have a letter from a retired Secret Service agent, Lyle Workman, like a letter of recommendation. And in that letter, which was written about probably 20 years ago, he says, for some reason, people will talk to Burl Bear, and they will tell him, openly tell him things they will not share with anybody else. They won't share with reporters. They won't share with their attorneys. But for some reason, they will tell Burl Bear. And thank God they do. And there are some other people that would have the same thing. Susan Murphy Milano had the same, and was blessed with the same gift. People would talk to her. I don't know why it is, but I'm happy about it.
Well, you have a background that really is not of a, you know, you have a background as an elite. You weren't, didn't spend all of your time in school. You were, you have a background in radio and sales and marketing and music. So you obviously were, by the time that you were writing True Crime, you had already established the ways to communicate with people and all kinds of people, which was a real benefit later on.
That's true. As I often joke about it, if it weren't for having a double life, I'd have no life at all. And and Barb, who I live with here, she always mocks us. I don't want to meet any more of your friends. If she meets some of these people that I know, she's terrified or shocked by, you know, because I know people from all social strata. Some of them I wouldn't bring home. Some of them I would gladly bring home. and some of you bring home is the culture shock. But I can transition between all levels of, not all, but I'd say most levels of American culture fairly easily. Although I may appear out of place, I can tell you a strange story. I wound up one night in a particular location of people that you would not necessarily feel 100% comfortable around. And the TV was on, and it was Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? And I'm watching that while there's other things going on in the house. And this other woman is in, and she's kind of watching it too. And it just happened to be, by sheer coincidence, I happened to know the answer to every question they asked. And so they go, you know, and I go, D, C, A, whatever, while all this other bizarre criminal behavior is taking place. And we get all done, and the lady looks at me, she goes, what the hell are you doing here? Because anyone who could answer, just what if you'd been sitting in that chair, you'd be a millionaire now. What the hell are you doing sitting in this room full of criminals? And I said, yeah, that's a good question. I can't really tell you. But, I mean, I was perfectly comfortable if I hadn't been so willing to play the game that was on TV, they probably wouldn't have been so suspicious of me. Like Adlai Stevenson in the room.
Your books are imbued with your personality, but also what's important, I think, for the listener to understand is that if your books didn't have this tone, the tone of that law enforcement would approve of, you're on the right side of the law, despite your understanding and comprehension of criminals. Like we mentioned, you understand when somebody is insane rather than a psychopathic killer, regardless of what the court has determined and the prosecution wants to put forward at a trial. But
well,
the tone that you preserve in these books.
I mean, a good law enforcement officer, if they're going to catch the bad guys, they're not going to be able to do it unless they can think like a criminal. And that is one of the first things I noticed, that people who do not understand how criminals think make all sorts of assumptions that are just absurd. It's like listening to conservatives and liberals talk about each other. Neither one knows what they're talking about. Making all sorts of assumptions that just are the product of someone's bizarre imagination or assumptions. No, that's not how those people think. No, that's not what they're up to. You know, but I can think like a criminal real easy. It's not difficult for me to have a criminal mind. And I'm not out to catch anybody, and I could keep a secret as well as the next criminal. And I think that's one reason people know they're safe with me, unless it's murder or child molesting. You know, that's a different story. People have usually got the brains not to tell me if they've killed somebody. There's no statute of limitations on that. But anything else, I'll tell people right up front, hey, as long as we're talking about anything from 7 years ago and beyond, as long as it's not murder, you could tell me anything. You know, yeah. You don't have to worry about anything. From law enforcement,
but I'm talking
either,
about,
which is true.
I'm talking about
Go
the
ahead.
Tone from law enforcement itself, though, in that do you have the respect from law enforcement that you're not going to put out something that's irresponsible factually whatsoever, and you're also have this reputation of having the tone to be on the right side of the fence here, not having undue, again, just presenting the facts, but your opinion, the end result of your books, the tone is appreciated by law enforcement,
yeah,
by
the
judiciary.
Yeah, that is a challenge. And on the Robert Lee Yates, when I went to Spokane, I was preceded there by, what's his name? He wrote a book about the same case, the guy from the O.J. trial, Furman, Mark Furman.
Furman. Mark Furman, yeah.
And he had pissed the cops off there so bad that when I showed up, they already didn't like me. Because he had written a true crime book, and it was so wrong, so filled with errors and just absurd mistakes. And, I mean, it was just beyond the beyond. And they were afraid that I'd be just as inaccurate, just as ridiculous and offensive to them as he was. Fortunately, I wasn't. But they really put me through the ringer on that book. I mean, it took me almost like a year and a half to get the pictures, which aren't that good anyway, from them when they had them sitting on the desk, but they wouldn't give them to me. Just made me wait. You know, all sorts of little games that went on. But I do got to compliment the guys that helped me out on that because they were great. The Homicide Task Force wasn't easy. But they were so mad at Furman for what he, the way he, you know, he had a radio show and he'd talk about him. Like, the reason he wrote his entire book was to show that he knew more than they did. But just as the book was about to come out, they caught the killer. And then he calls him up and goes, oh, tell me how you did it. And he said, told him a trick he could do in a hat and up a rope. They wouldn't tell him anything. And then I showed up and had to convince him that I wasn't him. So that can be a problem if you get the police mad at you.
Absolutely. Now, these books, you were published with from Pinnacle and now with Wild Blue Press as of late. Both very, very fine publishers that that specialize, I think, in the real true crime author and the dedicated, sophisticated true crime reader. Can you tell us a little bit about the process with, I know, with Kensington Press, how much they were involved in helping these books get to the end result that they were, as I mentioned, now true crime classics?
Yeah, well, you don't know it's going to be a true crime classic until enough time goes by. Same with films. You don't know what's going to be a classic film until it's years later. And say, how did I become my preeminent position in the true crime world? And it's simply by staying alive and reaching this age and writing enough books. Kensington, Karen Haas, who I must compliment, she's retired now. She was, I've had good editors. She is beyond a doubt the best editor I've ever had in the publishing world. I cannot say enough wonderful things about her. We had like a Vulcan mind meld. I would write all night until 6:30 in the morning, which would be 9:30 New York time, and then I would call her and tell her what I'd worked on and send it to her. And it was just like sort of like psychic connection. We could just tell what we were on the same page, literally. It was fantastic to work with her. And the process of picking a case to do, I just said to her, I'd say to her, here are four different cases I'd like to do. Pick the one you want. And then she'd say, okay, how about this one? What was funny is I'd get the, it was either her or Michael Hamilton that sent me the message one time that said, you did a lot of books about blue-collar criminals. But the market has changed. Things have gotten bad. The economy has gone to hell. So people want to read books about rich people with a lot of drugs who do stupid stuff. So that's why we did Fatal Beauty. Mm-hmm. So see if you can find some good-looking people with a lot of money and a lot of drugs and a lot of sex, and preferably a wood chipper.
I
never find the wood chipper. But, you know, there's market research. Like, there's a difference between a magazine and a newspaper. USA Today, which is looks like a newspaper, is not a newspaper. If you've ever seen it, in reality, it's a magazine. Because a magazine, they find out what you want to read, and then they print it. Newspaper just prints whatever the news is.
Mm-hmm.
Magazines print what you want to read. And same thing, research is done on what kind of true crime books you want to read. When the economy is good, you want to read about people who are lower economic levels, those low lives, they're just scumbags. And when the economy is bad and you're not one of those low lives, you want to read about rich people who are bad. Now, it's pretty simple to figure out. Everyone's always looking for someone to be better than. You know, like I said on the news, there's always a little clip of someone you can feel better than because your life's better than theirs. You know, it's part of this whole sales strategy. You know, meeting that need of feeling better than somebody else. I really don't need that myself. I just want to feel better than me. But they,
well, you know,
go ahead.
I very much like other literary forms, other magazines, books, things have gone through eras of more popularity.
just because of the nature of the criminals and the crimes, and I guess better crime solving than people, you know, serial killers running around for 15 or 20 years unsolved. So we know the history of America and where the police caught up, I guess, to some of these people. This is the what would be now, I guess, considered true crime classics, but also because of the crimes themselves and the criminals.
Mm-hmm.
Not to romanticize or anything, but very unique in terms of now when we have the spree killer, we have the one-off killer, we have the people that are in a big rush to get famous, not these other people that were slow and steady.
Yeah, hey, can I? Yeah. I'll chop this guy's head off and have sex with the eyeballs. You can write a book and I'll be famous. I mean, who thought of that? Well, we know who thought of that. But, I mean, that amazed me that that kind of stuff went down.
Yeah.
You know,
it's really amazing, Burl, that you were in the right position at the very, very right time with all the right intentions and all the skills, and you put together this collection, 9 truly important true crime books that
I urge
everyone to.
Well, we got another one coming. I got some more coming. I'm not done yet. I got one coming out real soon that's by yours, Handsome Truly, called, it's a 3-volume set, American Panther. The very first one's called Stealing Manhattan. And it's the never-before-told story of the greatest untold true crime story in American history involving the biggest mega heist, over $1 billion in diamonds, gems, precious stones, and cash stolen from the Diamond District in New York. And, yes, they got away with it. And everyone was in on it. The security companies, the safe manufacturing companies, everybody. And the guy who planned it all got away with everything, never went to prison. He's retired to Europe, invited me to go fishing with him. Incredible story, and it's all true. Got that coming out, and that's going to be a 3-volume set because the story is so incredible it takes 3 books to tell it. Each part is an adventure under itself. And then Frank and I have one that we're starting that will blow your mind. The fact that this even took place is astonishing. You have members of the Russian mafia who are going to prison, sworn in as federal agents, so they can arrest people to lower their prison time and figure, gee, if we could arrest somebody for murder, that'll really lower our prison time. And so they allegedly frame a retarded kid for murder to reduce their prison sentences.
Wow.
And I got all the info on that. And in fact, we've already got some TV film interest in that. So it's a true story. And Frank and I are just about to start on that one. So we've got some more great stuff coming. We're not done yet.
Absolutely. No, absolutely not. I'm not surprised at all. You're very prolific, and so is Frank. And so we will be looking forward collectively to Black Panther.
American Panther. Stealing Manhattan is the actual title of the first volume. Stealing Manhattan.
Wow.
The one Frank and I are doing, but we haven't gone over the title yet. But usually titles, when Kensington would come up with the titles. The original title of Headshot was Head in a Bucket. We didn't know what to call it. It's called Head in a Bucket.
Yeah. The glory days, Pinnacle really had their finger on the pulse.
Yeah, but they still doing a lot of true crime.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Absolutely.
They're still doing it, huh?
Well, there's less authors anyway, certainly.
Well,
I want to thank you. Yeah, the price.
Not as much
Burl,
money.
I want to thank you so much for joining me for the Burl Bear retrospective. It's been an absolute pleasure, even just touching on some of the stories that comprise the 9, again, classic true crime books, and, as you say, more to come. I want to thank you very much, Burl, for coming
My
on
pleasure.
And talking
thank
about this.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about True Crime Uncensored just before I let you go.
Okay, True Crime Uncensored is live every Saturday, 2 p.m. Pacific time, on outlawradiolive.com, and then you can listen to it on iTunes and Spotify in about 13 other delivery systems. I use Spotify. A lot of people use iTunes to listen to it. And if you find it irritating and aggravating and childish, that's okay. We have some really good guests like Dan Zapansky. We got Steven Singular this week. So we're going to have a good time. We're doing a career retrospective on him. So we'll teach him a lesson, him and his wife.
Thank you very much, Burl.
And Frank, have a good time.
Thank you very much, Burl. Good night.
Good night.